From KALW News in San Francisco, I'm Ben Trefney, and this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oakland, California.
Concord, California.
Fairfield.
Foothill.
Coming up, we're going for a little ride. Tearing up the streets of San Francisco on the silver screen.
From the 70s on, San Francisco became not only a site for films, but also as a place where important film directors were working.
The city is famous for car chases and vertiginous drops.
Will you tell me something? Has this ever happened to you before?
What?
Falling into San Francisco Bay.
Today, we're taking a tour through San Francisco's cinema, past and present, and we'll check in on the city's indie theaters and organists along the way.
Get the Pentagon and call the San Francisco office. It seems Alcatraz was just reopened.
Pop some corn and bring the house lights down. This is Cross Currents Movie Show. That's the sound of Steve McQueen burning rubber in the 1968 movie Bullet. It was filmed here in San Francisco. McQueen plays Bullet, a gutsy cop trying to bring down an organized crime leader. And to do that, he's got to drive fast.
You believe what you want. You work your side of the street, and I'll work mine.
Today, KALW's Jamie Katsoufis and I are driving Bullet's route as part of a show dedicated to cinema around the San Francisco Bay. Turn right here, Jamie. We've got some company for our tour. Say hey, Steven.
Hey, how are you doing?
Stephen Kovacs is a movie man, he's a Harvard PhD, and he co-produced the Oscar-nominated short doc Arthur and Lily in 1975. He's going to be with us throughout the show talking about San Francisco's film history, which makes sense because he's a professor of cinema studies at San Francisco State. Let's go back to Arthur and Lily for a moment. Tell me about that movie that you went to the Academy Awards for, Stephen.
We made a film about Arthur Mayer, a grand old man of the movies who had done everything, publicity and importing movies, with two very talented graduate students who have become great filmmakers since then, John Nelson, Chris Samuelson. And it's a little bit of a vignette of Hollywood in the old days.
So speaking of Hollywood, we are heading down Taylor Street towards the Bay waterfront. And what is happening here in the movie Bullet?
Actually, we look down Taylor Street and...
It's steep.
It's steep. It's very steep. And it's at the steepest part that we are at. And that's exactly where Steve McQueen was.
So, as we mentioned, Stephen Kovacs was Oscar-nominated for Arthur and Lily. And did you actually go to the Academy Awards ceremony?
We certainly did. This was the year when Jack Nicholson won an Oscar for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it was a good party. It was fun to be honored.
So many of us watch the Oscars, but not many of us have a chance to actually go to the ceremony like you did. Take a right here, Jamie. Could you tell me a little bit of something about what your experience was like there at the Academy Awards?
I think the funniest and most telling moment was when we drove up in the best car we could find and we opened the doors and we stepped out and there were literally thousands of people and hundreds of photographers looking at us, and we were in the center of attention, and they looked at us for 1 second and they realized we were nobodies. So then their attention passed.
So what happens in Bullet throughout this this car chase scene? Why is it so recognized as being so good?
Wow. I think it's one of the first really intricate car chase scenes that goes through San Francisco. And they've managed to put together some of the best hills of San Francisco. And I think that's what it is. Actually, if you see the movie, it's a fairly ordinary movie. And then comes a car chase scene. And that's what everybody talks about.
Jamie, hang a left.
And it just, you know, squealing tires and people being thrown left and right and Steve McQueen being in charge. And that's what gives it a thrill.
This is pretty much a perfect city to have car chase scenes, which work so well in movies. And there's a movie that I like called Foul Play from about 1980 with Chevy Chase and Goldie Hawn, which has a great car chase scene. Actually, they're in the back of a taxi cab as they're going through that. And another movie, What's Up, Doc?
What's Up, Doc, as well. Yeah, Peter Bogdanovich shot that film back in, in the late 60s. And again, it features this the terrific hills of San Francisco.
So we're heading down one of those hills of San Francisco right now, talking with Stephen Kovacs, who is a professor at San Francisco State University in the Cinema Studies Department. Jamie Katsoufis has given us a ride. as we come off of Russian Hill and the bullet chase scene right now, reminiscing about some of the other great car chases in San Francisco, including What's Up Doc and Foul Play. We're approaching the Golden Gate Bridge from the Marina District, and it's a landmark that's been in a number of movies also as San Francisco's great icon. It bore the brunt of a cosmic storm in Star Trek IV. It saw a cross-species battle in the recent Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and it provides the backdrop to a famous scene in Alfred Hitchcock's film Vertigo, which was filmed throughout San Francisco. We're pulling up near Fort Point right this moment, and while we park, let's listen to a clip. Here's James Stewart as a detective with a fear of heights, and Kim Novak as a woman he's becoming dangerously obsessed with.
I married you now.
Will you tell me something? Has this ever happened to you before?
What?
Falling into San Francisco Bay.
Oh. No, it's never happened before.
That's a scene from Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 film Vertigo. And I'm here at Fort Point with film historian Stephen Kovacs.
So Vertigo was shot in almost entirely in San Francisco, also down in Carmel. And what we have here is Alfred Hitchcock's fascination with San Francisco. And a number of places are shown in the film, including the cemetery in Mission Dolores, and Nob Hill, and he also came back here for the birds. And in fact, the birds opens up with Tippi Hedren walking across Union Square and going into a pet shop where Alfred Hitchcock is walking out of his signature appearance on screen with two little dogs.
He was in every movie he filmed, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. So you always his fans always look for him somewhere, and he was in the second shot of the birds.
And I guess Alfred Hitchcock was actually kind of a man about town to some extent. I mean, he had a home, you told me earlier, he had a home in Santa Cruz.
That's right. Very close to Santa Cruz, he had a home. He was fond of Northern California. He shot another film in Northern California, Shadow of a Doubt in Santa Rosa. So I think partly he was trying to escape from Los Angeles, and he really wanted to get the local flavor of these places.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the early history of filming in San Francisco. Tell me about the movie San Francisco itself. That was from 1936 with Clark Gable and Jeanette MacDonald.
Of course, that's the signature movie about San Francisco. Almost all of that was shot on MGM studio lots, but some of the background footage, of course, was shot in San Francisco. And there were some wonderful miniatures about the actual earthquake. But what we really think of in terms of old movies is The Maltese Falcon, where Spade and Miles Archer are operating the detective agency. And about 2 minutes into the film, Miles Archer gets killed on the corner of Bush and Stockton. And then we go on a few years later into a movie called Dark Passage.
Another Humphrey Bogart film.
Another Humphrey Bogart film, the third one he made with Lauren Bacall, which starts off in San Quentin, where he's escaping from. And very soon after, Lauren Bacall crosses Golden Gate Bridge with Humphrey Bogart in the trunk and drives to her apartment on Mason Street. And later on, we see Humphrey Bogart climbing up the steps of Filbert Street on Telegraph Hill. And the very, very end, all we have to do is turn around, Ben, and look at this little outcropping where Humphrey Bogart had a fight with a guy who was going to kill him.
And so we're here, just so you could picture it, we're here underneath the Golden Gate Bridge on the southern side, right at Fort Point, an old military installation, and we're looking at a little rocky outcropping.
And there's an altercation. He takes the gun from the other guy's hand, and he punches him out, and he falls and kills him. And so it's almost at the end of the movie. So the movie begins with the Golden Gate Bridge and almost ends with the Golden Gate Bridge.
Well, since we're right here at the Golden Gate Bridge, let's hear a clip from Dark Passage, a 1947 film noir starring Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall.
You know, it's wonderful when guys like you lose out. Makes guys like me think maybe we got a chance in this world.
Don't count me out so easy!
That's a scene from Delmer Dave's movie Dark Passage. You're listening to a special movie edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. We're back in the car now, heading away from the bay. That means another of the city's cinematic landmarks is behind us, the Island Prison, namesake star of Escape from Alcatraz, The Birdman of Alcatraz, and The Rock.
Get the Pentagon and call the San Francisco office. It seems Alcatraz was just reopened.
Most of the time I work in a glass jar and lead a very uneventful life. I drive a Volvo, beige one.
The Bay Area has a rich film history, but the future of the film industry as a whole is looking a bit fuzzy. Worldwide, studios are struggling. DVD sales are flagging, and piracy continues to be a thorn in the industry's side. Film advocacy groups have tried PSAs.
Digital piracy and product counterfeiting are not victimless crimes. The financial repercussions are huge. Show the world that piracy doesn't work. Do it.
Meanwhile, the industry has tried to go the congressional route and pass anti-piracy legislation. But none of these strategies has been especially effective, and revenue from ticket sales continues to trend steadily downwards, dropping by almost $1 billion between 2009 and 2011. But here's an even more telling statistic. The number of actual tickets sold in 2011 was the lowest it's been since 1995. People just aren't going to the theaters like they used to, and this has hit independent movie theaters in San Francisco especially hard. Take a left here, Jamie. Before he got in our car today, KALW's Jamie Katsoufis stopped by a few of San Francisco's iconic independent movie theaters, past and present, to see what sort of changes they were making to stay in business. Hey, Jamie, turn the music down, will you? And tell us your story.
Take a walk down any major street in San Francisco, and you'll see them. Dead movie theaters. Corpses. It's hard not to shudder when you walk past one. The door is locked and covered with plywood, the entrance collecting tin cans and old newspapers. The theater's once grand marquee, now deprived of the electricity needed to power the lights, seems gaudy and hubristic. These are dark times for movie theaters. July 25th, 2011. The Red Vic Theater became the city's latest victim. It had just turned 31 years old. When I arrived on the scene, San Francisco's iconic Haight Street, the theater lay in critical condition. One of the Red Vic's guardians, Jack Ricks, let me in to examine the victim, his theater. It was a bright, sunny day, and Rick seemed to be in a relatively cheerful mood, despite the recent tragedy.
Hey, are you Jamie?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Jack.
Nice to meet you.
Once inside, Ricks explained they were doing some emergency reconstructive surgery to help keep the Red Vic alive.
This is the old Red Vic Auditorium. The permanent fixed seats have all been taken out.
Back in the projection room, the heart of the theater, Ricks explained the Red Vic had a bum ticker.
We're finding we need to take out the old Red Vic projector, the 35mm. Apparently, what they're saying is they're going to quit making 35mm movies as of next year.
They are the Hollywood movie industry, Tinseltown. And when they go digital,
it's going to be all digital everywhere.
A brand new digital projector for the Red Vic could easily cost $70,000, an expensive procedure with a small chance of success in this case. As I poked around in dusty corners of the old theater, one fact became clear: the Red Vic would never be the same. I needed to know more about the theater's past, and Ricks was happy to oblige.
The Red Vic was so eclectic, we played everything. We would show a political documentary, then a second-run title, then something crazy like The Room, The Citizen Kane of bad movies.
Do you want me to order a pizza?
Whatever, I don't care.
I already ordered a pizza.
And sometimes it was high art, sometimes it was low art, but it was always film as art.
But as the years rolled by, something went wrong.
Toward the end, we probably had a group of maybe 20 or 30 people on a good night who would still show up for the movies. The audience really kept declining.
The theater was dying, slowly. But even more disturbing, Rick seemed to believe that the Red Vic was just the latest in a series of attacks. He pulled out the documents that appeared to prove it.
This is interesting. Looking at the San Francisco moving list, there were all these downtown theaters, the Electric, the Embassy, St. Francis 1 and 2, and the Strand. Those are all gone. The Alexandria is gone. The Alhambra is gone. The Balboa is still going, thank goodness.
A living witness. I was on my way. Balboa in San Francisco's Outerlands is the westernmost theater in the continental U.S. Its massive marquee shines through the fog like a beacon. And it was there, in a closet-sized office, that I found the man I was looking for. He was wearing a bowler cap and a white t-shirt.
My name is Roger Paul. I am the general manager of the Balboa Theater.
I asked him if he knew anyone who might want to see the Red Vic dead.
You know, back in the day, two theaters that really had a fierce competition with each other at one time were the Red Vic and the Roxy.
Was that it? An inside job? A fierce rivalry between two theaters that ended with the Red Vic beaten and bloodied? No, not here. These days, independent theaters have bigger fish to fry.
I think I speak for all of the theaters. We are not the competition. We are not the enemy. We are, in fact, the partisans. For us, I think it's all just a question of cooperating and promoting each other as best as possible.
So if they're in cahoots, who is the enemy? Did this go all the way to the top? Were the big film studios squeezing the life out of indie theaters one by one?
They've always been strange bedfellows where there's been a lot of distrust. I think that the entire industry is in flux right now. None of us can coast, whether it's the studios, the exhibitors, the chains, the large circuits, and most definitely the smaller neighborhood theaters.
I needed to get back to the fundamental facts of the case. The people of San Francisco love the idea of independent movie theaters, but
warm and fuzzies don't pay the PG&E bill. You need to have regular attendance.
The Balboa has tried art house movies, and it used to show double features, but Paul said that wasn't the ticket.
It becomes a lesson that the quality of a movie doesn't necessarily correlate to the size of the audience. And, you know, after you have enough busts showing all these great movies, you start to move away from them.
And towards the same fare the big chain multiplexes survive on. Blockbusters, romantic comedies, star vehicles.
What's the matter?
I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor. Not a tumor at all.
Again, you want to show the best movies that you can and that you're proud of, but that people want to see and that they don't look at and say, oh, that sounds great. We got to put that on my queue. You want the response to be, that sounds great. Let's head down to the theater tonight, honey.
There was something about what he said. A clue. A cue. Netflix cue. Ricks had mentioned something about home movies, too.
When Netflix started mailing the videos directly to homes, I noticed that our audience shrunk a little bit. And then when they started streaming, I really noticed that it seemed like the floor dropped out.
There it was, the murder weapons. Home theaters, couches, Netflix. But who was the murderer? Could we trace the trail of blood all the way back to a home entertainment service? No. DVD rentals don't kill theaters. People do. People like Jack Ricks, the oh-so-friendly caretaker of the Red Vic. I raced back to the theater and hauled him in for questioning.
You know, it's funny, even if you talk to people who work at movie theaters, usually we admit, if we're taking a lie detector test, that we do stream films and we do watch at home.
There it was, the confession. It was Ricks all along. Ricks and all his movie streaming cohorts. But my charge would never stick in court. Look, Your Honor, a nation of people all not going to the movies, throw them in the stir. No way. The only thing left to do is fight back. Arm the few remaining theaters with their own deadly weapons. Beer, wine, local food, a sense of community. As I canvassed the city, I noticed one theater was way ahead of me. For years, the Kabuki Theater in Japantown has been experimenting with the art of movie showing. The Kabuki used to be in shabby shape, an old AMC struggling to survive, but since 2006, everything in the theater has been replaced, except a few carpets. I met a woman who was behind the makeover.
Nancy Gribbler, Vice President of Marketing for Sundance Cinemas.
She works on behalf of a larger umbrella organization, the Sundance Group. They run the Sundance Movie Festival, a related resort, but they've also been remodeling a handful of old theaters across the country. I followed her into the theater.
This is what we call the Big Kabuki, which is auditorium number one.
A big screen, comfy wool seats, and upstairs, the most lethal weapon.
This is our balcony bar on the third floor, and at night it opens up.
Their facilities were state-of-the-art. Their battle plan, elegant.
We don't have television commercials. All of the seats are reserved. Everything here is compostable, recyclable. We take a great deal of care.
High class.
And it's really important to us that the whole experience is pleasurable and comfortable. And you're there for that moment when the lights go down and you see a movie on the screen. It's just so magical.
But every theater can't afford wool seats, liquor licenses, 3D capability. And the Kabuki makes you pay. During prime hours, it charges a $3 amenity fee per ticket on top of the price of the movie itself. That's not a sacrifice everybody is willing to make. I ran it by Roger Paul of the Balboa to see what he thought.
I have heard a lot of snarky comments about reserve seating, but you know, the interesting thing about that, and even though I'm not a fan of reserve seating, is that they did something different, and I think that San Francisco theaters can learn from them. None of us, and not even the Sundance Kabuki, can rely on what's worked in the past.
The bodies of dead theaters are still scattered throughout the city, a testament to the need for change. The Alexandria, the Coronet, the Strand.
The Ghirardelli, the Kokusai, the Mercury. I don't even remember the Mercury. The Surf. That was a sad day when the Surf closed.
The names ring in my ears. It's been a dark time for independent movie houses in San Francisco. But I can see a flicker in the projection booth. There's still life in the old theater. And tomorrow is another day. In San Francisco, I'm Jamie Katsoufis for Cross Currents.
What's your favorite movie theater in the Bay Area and why? Maybe it's one that isn't around anymore, like The Surf, out where I live in San Francisco's Outer Sunset, or maybe The Coronet on Geary. Tell us about your choice at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, taking a driving tour of the city's movie history with KALW's Jamie Katsoufis and San Francisco State film professor Stephen Kovacs. And we are actually on Lombard Street, just east of Hyde, heading down the curviest road in the Bay Area and maybe the world. This is a pretty good one to have a car chase scene on, isn't it, Stephen?
I don't think there has been a car chase scene here because I don't know why. I guess it's, you just can't go that fast.
Exactly. What are we doing here, Jamie? How fast are we going?
Zero.
But still, it's a pretty good iconic street to represent how steep these hills in San Francisco are. Just listening there back to Jamie's story about independent movie theaters, I remember the Coronet, Stephen. It's a huge theater, and it's where Star Wars debuted.
That's right. Actually, I was there when Star Wars debuted, gives my age, and I remember seeing The Mutiny on the Bounty there, not the black and white version, but the one with Marlon Brando. And actually, I grew up next to the Surf Theater, so I got a really good film education. I just thought everybody saw these old movies. And the Surf was a unique theater on 46th and Irving, which operated for, I don't know, 15 or years or so.
So as we wend our way down Lombard Street, I want to talk with you about one of the classic eras of movie history, Stephen, and that is the 1970s. That has a special significance here in the Bay Area. I mean, we were just talking about the Coronet Theater. George Lucas' Star Wars really started the whole Lucas franchising. Tell me a little bit more about that era.
The 1970s were a very important era for American movies because that's when the people who grew up in the 60s began to make films. And they were influenced by the cultural changes and by the importance of the director as the head of the film. So Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, Peter Bogdanovich were that generation. And two of these people, Lucas and Coppola, moved up to San Francisco and they brought their friends with them. Carol Ballard, director of The Black Stallion. Walter Murch, who is maybe the most important editor, picture and sound, in the history of cinema. So they made San Francisco a film location. And also at the same time, Saul Zantz of Fantasy Films began to make some very important and very interesting films as a producer. Amadeus, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and a number of others. So from the 70s on, San Francisco became a not only a site for films, but also as a place where important film directors were working.
So as we continue down Lombard into North Beach, where Coppola actually has a lot of ties, tell me a little bit about Walter Murch. Since we're a sound program, I think this is a good opportunity to explore some of the work that he did. What are some of the movies that he's most famously affiliated with?
Walter started with Coppola and worked with him on his most important films, The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, and a number of others. And really, he is the one who pioneered sound design before people were just putting good sound effects to films. And he realized how much he could do with sound. And it is, and his films have won Oscars. And in fact, I know he is the only person to have won an Oscar both as a picture editor and as a sound editor. And there are fantastic examples in all of his work.
Well, let's go ahead and hear a montage of very familiar sound examples from the wonderful sound designer Walter Murch, a Bay Area movie maker.
I love you.
Do you renounce Satan?
I do renounce him.
That sound from the movies The Conversation, The Godfather, and Apocalypse Now, all by sound designer Walter Murch from the Bay Area. We've taken a pit stop on our journey around the city here at the corner of Columbus, Kearny, and Pacific, and I'm here with Stephen Kovacs. He's a film historian from San Francisco State University. Walter Murch really launched a big sound design industry here in San Francisco. Tell me about it, Stephen.
This is something that very few people except the insiders know, and that is that San Francisco became, in the 1970s, partly because of Walter Murch, really the most important sound center in the world in motion pictures. In fact, a number of Hollywood films continue to come up here to make to finish their sound work here. People like Gary Summers, Gary Rydstrom, I have worked with, have received a number of Academy Awards for The Titanic, for Jurassic Park, and a number of others. So both at Lucasfilm's sound stages and also Fantasy Films' sound stages in Berkeley, these people are working, and they are absolute masters of sound.
So we are here at this corner where Walter Murch's good friend and colleague, Francis Ford Coppola, has a significant building, a beautiful triangular-shaped building. It is a green color, and there's a cafe at the bottom called Cafe Zoetrope. Tell me a little bit about this place, Stephen.
Coppola bought this after the success of The Godfather, and he is one filmmaker who really has lived and promoted San Francisco. He has a little apartment, I believe, still in this area, and he bought this building. He has his office is there. He has editing rooms where I've done some editing. He has opened Cafe Zoetrope down below. He is part of the North Beach scene and part of San Francisco. And he shot at least, well, to me, maybe his one of his great films, The Conversation, in San Francisco, starting off in Union Square.
So we are here on Columbus Street under the shadow of the Transamerica Pyramid. Let's go ahead, Stephen, and walk up Columbus Street here. We're going towards City Lights Booksellers. This is really a strong arts district, and there's a lot of artists who come here. And we're going towards a hotspot for artists, especially around the time of the Academy Awards. Tell me about Tosca.
The owner of Tosca is a lady named Jeanette Etheridge, who has always been a, I guess, matron, not patron, of the arts in San Francisco. And Tosca's is a beautiful old bar, which has become a center for artists and particularly filmmakers. So from the 70s on, directors like Francis Ford Coppola, Philip Kaufman, producers like Saul Zantz, George Lucas would stop by here. And it is still a center. So practically when any filmmaker comes from anywhere in the world, they will stop by at Tosca's. Wim Wenders, who made the film Hammett, spent some time here. Werner Herzog. So it really is a center. People from the San Francisco Film Society come here. It is right opposite City Lights Bookstore. And it is a wonderful place. In fact, I believe it has been in a number of films, featured in a number of these films.
So this isn't just a who's who of Bay Area filmmaking. This is really a who's who in the history of film overall. And a lot of it's right here in Coppola country in North Beach, San Francisco. What's your favorite Bay Area movie memory? Share your thoughts on the greatest director, the best movie, or the most memorable scene on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, taking a trip through San Francisco's movie history. And now our driver, KALW's Jamie Katsoufis, is driving across downtown toward the Grand Dome of San Francisco's single-screen movie houses, the Castro Theater. Its marquee is nearly as recognizable in the city as that fab rainbow flag that flies just a block up at the corner of Market. The Castro was built in 1922 for $300,000. From the outside, it looks like a Mexican cathedral. Inside, more than 1,400 seats face a stage and screens surrounded by large organ grills, the windpipes of a mighty Wurlitzer. And our next story is about a man who can make that organ sing, Jim Riggs. He's among a handful of people in the world who can handle the massive instrument with its 1,800 pipes, 244 keys, and 32 foot pedals. Reporter April Demboski sat down with Riggs at another Bay Area landmark, the Paramount Theater in Oakland, to talk about the history of the organ, Riggs' technique, and what it's like being a celebrity best recognized by the back of his head. Jamie, please hit play.
Can you explain the anatomy of the organ? It seems very complicated.
Well, they are really the most complicated musical instrument devised. Okay, you have the key desk or the console, and that has the keyboards that your fingers and feet play, plus the stops. In this case, they're little celluloid tongues. On a classical organ, they're little knobs that pull out from the side. Now, what actually makes the sound are the organ pipes. And those are way up in the organ, what people used to call organ lofts or chambers. And then providing all that wind is the blower, and that's down in the basement. All those little buttons and stop tabs and keys and whatnot mean next to nothing to the general public, but I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "Boy, that looks like the cockpit of a 747.
You actually write some of the compositions for some of the silent films that are shown here at the Paramount. What's your creative process for doing that?
Oh, well, there's a lot of ways you can do it. The most authentic method would be to play the original score, and all silent films came with a score of some sort. However, a lot of those do not survive. The next most authentic method would be to employ only music that was contemporary with the film. What I like to do, rather than just a straight improvisation, I call it a prepared improvisation. And the key to that is to know the picture really well, to view a DVD or a print or a VHS copy many, many times. So I know where the pratfalls are, when somebody gets shot, when a kiss happens, when some dramatic moment is coming up. You've got to know the sequence of the narrative very, very intimately. Then I compose motifs, slight short themes for the major characters, sometimes major scenes if it's dramatically warranted. And then, having prepared all that and knowing what's going to happen when, I can weave together all those elements during performance in this sort of prepared improvisation.
What happened in the 50s and 60s that kind of led to the decline in the organ that we are now resurfacing from?
The little screen television. That's what did it. That's what pretty much nearly killed off the movie industry. And, of course, property values of old movie palaces like the Paramount here, they became high enough that it was more profitable to actually tear down the theaters, build a parking lot or some sort of development. And that happened all over the country. We were losing these wonderful buildings. Northern California has been a real center for the rebirth of this kind of instrument. And there are a lot of people that play it.
A lot of people who come to the theater know of you, but not a lot about you.
Isn't that the truth? They know the way I look from the back. Isn't that the truth? Yeah, I mean, I've played for, I don't know, over a million people in the Bay Area the last 20-something years, but they don't know what my face looks like. Matter of fact, years ago, I took a Craigslist personal ad out, and it went something like, you ever wondered who that organist playing at the Paramount or the Castro Theater? What's he's like? Because you never see his face. And it went on like that. Actually, got a couple of nice responses, too.
After that musical interlude, we're back in the car. We're hearing Steve McQueen making his own rules as an end justifies the means cop in the 1968 film Bullet. But we're taking our own historic trip through the city's cinematic history with our driver, KALW's Jamie Katsoufis, and our private tour guide, San Francisco State professor and film historian Stephen Kovacs. Stephen, let's move up to the now and talk about the state of cinema in the Bay Area today. What are your impressions?
San Francisco has been a very important film center for a long time, with independent filmmakers from the 1950s on. I mentioned sound specialists and directors and writers and actors. And those talented people continue to work here. There are fewer films coming up from Los Angeles because the production companies are really looking to save money. And in order to do that, they will come to San Francisco if a movie is set in this city and shoot a few exteriors, and the rest of it they will shoot somewhere else. Very often, let's say in Vancouver, which is comparable in terms of topography, and even on sound stages in Los Angeles. So in some sense, we have lost big business in San Francisco. However, among filmmakers, we still have a great number of talented people and new filmmakers coming up.
We've been speaking with cinema professor and Oscar-nominated filmmaker Stephen Kovacs from San Francisco State University. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thank you, Ben.
The end. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Rose Arrieta, Hannah Baba, Sarah Bernard, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Carolina Hidalgo, Chris Hoff, Artyom Konohov, Casey Miner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Lisa Ratner, Stephen Short, and Antoinette Sue. Today's show was engineered by sound designer Seth Samuel. It was driven by Jamie Katsoufis. Holly Kernan is our news director. Thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org, and thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffy.
You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?